This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
How do? Welcome to the broadcast. Good to have you aboard, all my listeners, my friends, my extended radio family. Getting ready to bug out at 550 Queen Street East here in Toronto. The good. Just a few weeks hence, we'll be moving down the Queen Elizabeth or down Lakeshore Boulevard, I guess. Just west of here. Moving into our new digs, the flagship station of our burgeoning little network here on The Conspiracy Show, AM 740, is pulling stakes and moving, as I say, down the road to a beautiful new facility. And I just had the pleasure of doing a little tour. And they're still, you know, drywalling and probably still are at this late hour, just trying to get things ready. But I'm really excited about this new place. It just looks gorgeous. And I have to say, though, I'm going to miss this place. A lot of character, this old building. Listen, I hope you're enjoying sort of the Easter season, shall I say. Always confusing for me, Orthodox Christian, there is sort of the Protestant Catholic Easter. Of course, we're into the Easter season now. And then the Orthodox Easter actually is like a month hence, the end of April, which is about the latest it can be. And, so I get to benefit. Well, what does it mean? It means two lovely glazed hams for Buddy. That's what it means. One now and one a little bit later. And, of course, you know, the kids enjoying the Easter egg hunts. And how do I, you know, bring this all home? I guess the Easter egg hunt is all about one type of rabbit. And in this program, we take you down a different rabbit hole. And we're going to do that tonight. We are getting set, of course, to commemorate the 45th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Some would say state execution, and I think my first two guests tonight would concur with that. Here to sort of disabuse us of the official version of events that transpired April 4th, 1968 at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. And that's where we're going this first hour. Hope you'll be aboard for that. Let's welcome aboard William Francis Pepper, barrister in the United Kingdom, admitted to the bar in numerous jurisdictions in the United States of America, is primarily involved in international commercial law. He's represented governments in the Middle East, Africa, South America, Asia. Today, he represents Sirhan Sirhan, the gunman convicted, of course, in the assassination of Senator Robert F. Kennedy in June 1968. But he was a friend of Dr. Martin Luther King in the last year of his life. Some years after King's death, Bill Pepper went on to represent James Earl Ray in his guilty plea and subsequent conviction. Pepper believes that Ray was framed by the federal government and that King was killed by a conspiracy that involved the FBI, the CIA, the military, the Memphis police, and organized crime figures from New Orleans and Memphis. He later represented James Earl Ray in a televised mock trial in an attempt to get Ray the trial that he never had. And then, of course, the civil trial, the wrongful death civil trial, King family versus Lloyd Jowers and other unknown conspirators. We'll get into that in a moment. That took place in Memphis in 1999. In that civil trial, the jury exonerated James Earl Ray. Also joining us, Cynthia McKinney, an American politician, activist. As a member of the Democratic Party, she served 6 terms in the United States House of Representatives. She has made a career of speaking her mind and challenging authority. She began on day one of her political life and hasn't looked back with her opinions, actions, and even her sense of style. McKinney has inspired both admiration and controversy. During her second term, her district was redrawn and renumbered the 4th district. She protested the new boundaries but was still elected to the seat. She was a supporter of a Palestinian state in Israel-occupied territory, sparked controversy by criticizing American policy in the Middle East. And Cynthia pressed for government transparency and accountability and introduced legislation to release the documents related to the murders of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Tupac Shakur. She was the first member of Congress to file articles of impeachment against George Bush, and she voted against every war funding bill put before her. First of all, let's say hello to William Francis Pepper. Hello, Bill. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show.
Yes, hello there.
And Cynthia McKinney, good to have you aboard as well. Thank you. Happy Easter to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's begin with you, Bill, if we could. And let's talk about the civil trial in 1999. Did you initiate that, or did the King family come to you? How did that come about?
Well, James died in 1998, and we sort of were at the end of the road in terms of trying to get the truth out about how Martin King was killed. And I entered into discussions with the family about what the options were, and we decided jointly to go forward in the civil action against Lloyd Jowers, who was the owner of Jim's Bar and Grill, behind which the shot was fired that killed Martin. And we had picked up enough evidence over the years to show that Jowers had a knowing involvement in the assassination, and so it was suitable for him to be sued, and we decided to go forward with that trial.
Jowers testified in that trial by, was it affidavit, or how did he? How did Jowers?
No, he never took the stand in the trial. He had been interviewed by myself and Dexter King, and then Andy Young, and Dexter. And in the course of those interviews, he had laid out his involvement in the assassination, and he had effectively admitted what he had done, and so those were the statements that we used to go forward against him.
Why did you believe Lloyd Jowers, or why should we believe that
Well, it wasn't just believing Jowers. We had enough evidence. We had people who saw him in meetings and involved with the actual assassination. He had a witness who had been his mistress, who was in the kitchen when he ran in carrying the still smoking rifle, watched him break it down and wrap it in a cloth and take it back out to the kitchen. I mean, we had enough independent evidence to go after Jowers.
You called something like 70 witnesses to the stand?
Yes, we had some 70 witnesses who testified over a 30-day trial.
And, I mean, we've talked about this in the past, but the fact that there was, I believe, only one working journalist who covered that trial. Let me bring Cynthia McKinney in as well in on this. And Cynthia, you and I talked about this recently. Not really a surprise that this wasn't covered by the mainstream media, was it?
No, and we shouldn't be surprised when the mainstream or corporate stream or special interest stream media fail to accurately cover important stories of today. But I was just reviewing the testimony, the extremely compelling testimony of William Schapp, who discussed the CIA involvement in the media, in buying the media. And I was also reviewing the church committee reports that documented the CIA participation in publishing houses, journalists, media outlets, and this is even going against the CIA charter of being involved inside the United States proper, but the CIA violated their charter and used what was Frank Wisner called the Grand Wurlitzer approach to media, so that they could sit back and watch as people danced to the tune that they played. So this is the way in the counterintelligence program that they shaped people's views of activists who really were only trying to make the United States more responsive to the needs of, for example, Native Americans, Blacks, and radical militant whites who supported the claims for social justice of these various groups.
I want to get into, you know, why Dr. King was targeted. And William, you knew Dr. King sort of the last year of his life. And a year to the date before he was shot, he delivered the speech maybe that I guess was what put it, you know, what really put him over the top in terms of, I guess, his perceived threat to the intel, you know, the military-industrial complex. Take me back to April 4th, 1967. Talk to me about that speech that he delivered and why that was so pivotal.
Well, Martin King was an immensely courageous human being. And I came back, I only met him when I came back from Vietnam, and Ramparts magazine published an article I wrote called The Children of Vietnam, which described exactly what was going on out in the country and what was happening to the civilian population, who most of whom were 15 years of age or under, or very, very old. And the photographs of the burned and maimed children in particular just tore into him. He openly wept in my presence when those files were revealed to him, and he just said he could no longer be silent. He had taken positions that, you know, were leading toward him opposing the war, but now he decided he had to come out fully. And the Riverside speech, April 4, 1967, was the key.
Okay, let me just jump in here, Bill. I've got to take a timeout. We'll come back. Cynthia McKinney, William Francis Pepper, as we commemorate the 45th anniversary of the assassination, some say the state execution, of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Welcome back. William Francis Pepper is with us, along with Cynthia McKinney, as we commemorate the 45th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And William Francis Pepper represented the King family in a civil trial back in 1999 that exonerated James Earl Ray as Dr. King's killer. Cynthia McKinney was served six terms in the United States House of Representatives and really pushed the government to release documents concerning the assassination of Dr. King. So I guess, you know, as long as Dr. King was, you know, talking about civil rights and supporting sanitation workers and so forth, that was fine. But when he starts, you know, labeling his government, as the United States, as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, that's when he became a threat. Is that when it really turned around?
No, I think that was not the primary reason he was killed. I mean, of course, it was he was pushing the envelope, and he was such a powerful a force that him opposing the war was very serious, and he was maligned everywhere, called a traitor, and it took a great deal of courage. But why he was ultimately killed, not for the words and not even for the swaying of opinion, but they don't kill you for that. They kill you when you become a serious threat to the system itself and the security of the system and the well-being of corporations and the subtle system of corporate fascism, which has dominated this country for so long. They killed him when he was going to bring to Washington in that spring 500,000 people who were going to not march, but going to stay there, going to visit their elected representatives and try to get money put back into the social programs that had been taken out because of the war. And they were going to camp, and they were going to be there. And they were seen as a potentially revolutionary force. You have to remember what the context. 100 cities had burned that year. The streets of Paris were the scene of a revolutionary movement that virtually was prepared to overthrow the government of Charles de Gaulle and create a new republic. And if it hadn't been for André Malraux dealing with de Gaulle and effectively teaching him how to co-opt the communists and the labor unions and leaving the students hanging out by themselves, then you might well have had that revolution in France. All of this was going on at the time, and the military knew they didn't have the troops to put down any upsurge of violence in the nation's capital, and they were afraid that that would result when there would be ultimate failure in terms of the achieving of the goals that this movement had. So Martin was never going to be allowed to bring that mass of humanity, mass of impoverished, miserable humanity, as well as individuals across the spectrum who supported that plight, to Washington. He was not going to be allowed to leave Memphis alive, and that was clearly, in my view, what led to his assassination.
Cynthia, you and I talked a few weeks ago off air about the motivation here to get rid of him, and even before the decision, whenever that was made, to kill Dr. King, the attempts to discredit him. You talked to me about the motivation, wanting to get him out, and this, the elite, the establishment, they wanted their guy, their choice, to lead, the civil rights movement. They wanted someone else in there. They wanted to co-opt the movement. Talk to me about that. Are you still with us, Cynthia? Did we lose Cynthia? Can you hear us, Cynthia McKinney? She's there, apparently, but she can't hear us. Let's try to reconnect with her. William...
No, where is Cynthia? Where is she located now?
She's in Georgia. She's, I believe she's joining us from Atlanta tonight.
Okay.
But she'll join us again in a few moments. But you had... Cynthia had talked to us, or talked to me, about, again, this motivation of wanting to get Dr. King out, discredit him, and bring their own person in there, someone that they could co-opt and control. Do you think that has any credence?
Yes, I certainly do. I mean, I think that that's always the tactic. If they could discredit and get rid of a leader such as Martin King and replace him with someone else who can be co-opted and controlled, that's certainly a tactic. Assassination, political assassinations, are the last resort, and everything else is normally tried beforehand in terms of control, manipulation, co-option. But if that does not work, and then assassination is a tactic that is used.
The jury in the civil trial in Memphis found Jowers responsible and found that the assassination plot included also governmental agencies. Can you talk to me about which governmental agencies specifically might have been involved or were involved?
Well, I mean, the evidence pointed to the involvement of intelligence agencies as well as the Bureau, And of course, on the scene, the local police department involvement was pretty well set out. And the ultimate contract, of course, was given to the mafia as a cutout device, which is not unknown as well. And so the Marcello organization used its Memphis people to work with the local police and set this up on the ground in Memphis.
Is that where Jowers comes in? He was hired by the mafia?
Well, Jowers owed a great deal of money to Frank Liberto, who was a local lieutenant of the Lucchese organization in Memphis, which was a part of the Marcello group. So Jowers was told that this debt would be forgiven and he would be paid quite a large sum of money if he would cooperate. And his place was ideally suited because it backed onto the Lorraine Motel and was a heavily brush-filled area behind his bar and restaurant, and so it was an ideal situation for him to become involved in, and he did. He also bought a taxi company himself sometime after the assassination with the proceeds of funds that he received.
Let me just check in to see if Cynthia has rejoined us. She's joining us on Skype, and we're not able to reach her on phone. Cynthia, are you there? No, we'll keep working on trying to get Cynthia McKinney back. In the meantime, William Francis Pepper stays with us. And
I'm sorry we lost Cynthia.
As am I, but I'm sure we'll get her back.
I'm sorry that the United States Congress lost Cynthia. We need Cynthia McKinney back in the Congress. Not that she necessarily is going to change policy with this crowd, but that she could get up every day like John Quincy Adams did in the 19th century. And just speak that truth and inveigh those kinds of values that this republic has long since moved away from. And that's the brilliance of Cynthia and her independence. So she needs to figure a way of getting back into the Congress just so that she is there and that she can rise and she can speak. And her words would be in that record.
Who would have had to have signed off on the assassination within government? Would J. Edgar Hoover's fingerprints be on this?
Of course. No. The assassination was signed off at the highest level.
The highest level. You're talking executive order, or
I'm talking about the President of the United States. This would not have taken place.
Lyndon Johnson
without Johnson's full knowledge and agreement.
Were the same...
Remember, he announced 4 days before that he was not going to run again.
And you think there's a connection?
Oh, of course there's a connection.
Can you expound on that? Explain further. Why?
Well, Johnson knew this was coming down, and it was coming down on his watch. And he didn't, in my view, he would not want to have withdrawn from political life and from running again for the presidency in the face of or after the assassination. And so it was timely for him to agree not to run and to publicly announce that he wasn't going to run again before the assassination.
Let's go back to the flophouse across from the Lorraine Motel. Oh, do we have Cynthia back? Cynthia McKinney, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Ah, delighted to have you back. Thank you, Cynthia. I wanted to get you also to comment on something I mentioned earlier, just before we lost you, and that is one of the reasons to get rid of Dr. King was because the establishment wanted to co-opt that movement, the civil rights movement, and put their person in there. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, hi, Bill. It's an honor to be on the same radio show as William Pepper. I mean, you know, you can't get much better than that when it comes to helping to unravel these massive lies and deceptions that have been carried out by our government that ended up with national icons being killed. And so I was also thinking about Bobby Kennedy and William Pepper's involvement around that assassination as well. So why would Dr. King have been seen as inconvenient? A group of Freedom of Information Act researchers were able to learn certain information about the last days of Dr. King. And in one particular document, the thinking behind the need to get rid of Dr. King, and I call it regime change on Black America, on Black people in the United States, because this document said somewhere at the top, there must be a Negro leader who is clean, who can step into the vacuum and chaos once Dr. King is either exposed or assassinated. This document was dated May 11th, 1965. And basically what it outlines is the need for, and this is gone into further in the church committee reports about how the certain government, U.S. government operatives decided that they were just going to figure out a way to declare the leadership of the Black community before the Black community had a chance to declare its own leadership. And this is all spelled out very, very carefully in a series of FBI memos and in this CIA memo as well.
That's pretty damning. Listen, we're about to take a break. When we come back, I want to get back to the Lorraine Motel. And Bill, I want to talk to you about two very interesting witnesses, one of whom was committed to a mental institution after she said what she saw. And the other witness, whose testimony, I guess, basically sort of sealed the fate of James Earl Ray, was supposedly drunk, incapacitated, unconscious in bed at the time. We'll talk about more of the state execution of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with William Francis Pepper and Cynthia McKinney right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away. If you cannot be stirred, emotionally moved by the words you just heard coming out of Dr. Martin Luther King, then you hath not a heart that beats. I don't care if you're white, black, or purple. And I guess that's what made him so powerful and so dangerous. William Francis Pepper is with us, Cynthia McKinney, as we talk about the 45th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Back to the flophouse above Jim's Grill, William, two very interesting witnesses. Tell me about one they chose to ignore and sent to a mental institution, and the other they chose to believe, but from what I remember or understand, he was drunk and unconscious and in bed.
Well, Gray Stevens, I mean, they were both alcoholics, and Grace and Stevens and old Charlie Stevens lived upstairs in the room next to the room that was rented by James under instructions. But Grace saw someone going down the back stairs before the shooting. The room James rented, and he was kept out of it most of the afternoon, sent on errands and various things. He was gone. It was used as a staging ground. And at one point, a member of the team was going down the stairs, and Grace saw him and mentioned that she saw him. Well, she had to be discredited. It wasn't all that difficult because she did have a drinking problem, but she was quite clear about having seen this person going down the stairs. As for her common-law husband, Charlie, some minutes before the shooting, a taxi driver named McCraw came up to pick up Charlie Stevens because he received a call that Charlie needed a taxi to take him somewhere. So old James came up, went up the stairs to take Charlie out, and he opened the door and he saw him passed out, his head on the table, and so drunk that he was certainly not capable of going anywhere with him. So he left, and he left Charlie just there with his head on the table. Now this is the state's eyewitness who supposedly identified James from the rear. They identified someone going down the hallway and going out the front door of the building. One of the other things McCraw said was that the bathroom door was open and the light was on. There was no one in the bathroom. When he was there and leaving, there was no one in the bathroom. And, of course, the state's position has always been the shot came from the bathroom, that James went in there, locked himself in, and straddled the sides of the bathtub and managed to shoot Dr. King. Well, McGraw puts that lie to rest. He went out downstairs, got back in his taxi, and started to drive away. And in a very short time, it came over, the word of the shooting came over the radio, and he heard it. So it's not at all believable that Charlie Stevens could have awakened and become totally sober and cognizant, could see everything, and that the bathroom door would have been occupied and shut, and the shot would have come from there. So that's the story of those two witnesses.
Cynthia, you're serving in the United States House of Representatives at this time. While this trial is going on, how did it make you feel, you know, representing a representative of the United States federal government, and knowing what you know about the complicity of certain individuals within the United States government, and here you are part of that government? How did that make you feel? I think we've lost Cynthia again. Let me ask you this, William. I mean, someone who practices law, the rule of law, doesn't seem to mean much of anything these days. And if the United States government was involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., then what does that say about the law? What does that say about the Constitution?
Well, I mean, it pretty much reduces it to meaningless words on paper. It is, however, the only recourse we have. There are people of integrity involved with the criminal justice system and involved with the government of the United States. And they very often become very upset with what they see and what they hear, and sometimes they become what's known as whistleblowers, right? And for that precise purpose. It's very frustrating. I think the lawyers who get involved in these kinds of political cases, when the pressures are so enormous on the courts and the judges to just keep the lid on the truth. You know, we just filed on Friday a response to the magistrate's report on the Sirhan case, the assassination of Bob Kennedy, it's a detailed filing. And we encourage everyone to read it, because the magistrate has, for many, many, many years, presided over the relegation of the truth and the facts in that case.
Bill, I got to jump. I got to go into a break here. We'll come back. The state execution of MLK on The Conspiracy Show. William Francis Pepper stays with us. Cynthia McKinney, I think we've rejoined Cynthia as we discuss the state execution of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., as we near the 45th anniversary. Cynthia, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Let me ask you, you were serving the United States House of Representatives 6 terms. How did that feel, serving in the U.S. government, knowing what you know about how Dr. King was disposed of by the government. How did that make you feel?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that the United States itself is a country that was born on the genocide of indigenous people, and then built on genocide and founded on genocide, and then built with a crime against humanity in the transatlantic slave trade. So I'm not fooled or misled by the propaganda that comes out of the government. I understand very clearly what the United States government is capable of doing. And so it's one thing to have these ideas. It's quite another thing, though, to see the documentation and the documentation around the counterintelligence program, the documentation that in the Church Committee reports, the specific information on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But the most damning of all is the December 1999 jury decision that William Pepper is responsible for us knowing about. And that is the entire trial where he brought out all of the details about fabricated down to the minute details of the cover story around the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And that's why this filing that William Pepper has just done on Sirhan is so important, because the same way they constructed the lie about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his murder is the same way the lie was constructed about the murder of Bobby Kennedy. And not only do the people of the United States have the right to know what happened to their leaders, but these assassinations affected U.S. policy around the world. And so the global community also has a right to know what happened to these particular individuals who championed peace, and as a result of their murders allowed the United States to move to without any kind of friction, I guess is the word that should be used, toward a policy of endless war.
Bill, was the slug that was removed from Dr. King ever properly matched to the alleged murder weapon?
No. No, there never was a match, and the alleged murder weapon was a throwdown gun. That was not the alleged weapon at all. No, there was no match. But you know, the same thing. I mean, Cynthia's quite right. She's talking about the Sirhan case. Same thing is true in the Sirhan case. None of the bullets from Sirhan's gun had ever been matched to any of the victims, and there were a number of people who were wounded by shots flying all over the pantry. Sirhan's arm was pinned to the table, steam table, after he fired. He managed to fire two shots. He got off two shots. He was under hypnoprogrammed control. We've gone through this in great detail with Professor Brown from Harvard, who's had Sirhan on free recall and hypnosis for over 70 hours. And we know the extent of the hypnoprogramming, the fact that they use chemicals as well as hypnosis, where it took place. I mean, we've broken that case as well. And we had 12 witnesses who said Sirhan was always in front of Bob Kennedy, never behind him. And Bob was hit, of course, by three bullets at powder burn range from the rear. It's impossible for Sirhan to have done that. Then his arm was pinned, and he kept pulling the trigger in robot-like fashion, and the bullets went all over the place. And the neck bullet that was taken from Bob Kennedy was not the neck bullet that was introduced at trial. We've established factually, without dispute, that they substituted a bullet. Sirhan's lawyer was under indictment at the time throughout the entire trial, through the trial, did not challenge the state on anything, accepted all of the ballistics evidence. And this was a farce, total farce. And they've kept this case out of court and kept this innocent Patsy in prison for all these years on the basis of procedural defects, because previous lawyers had missed filing times and things of that sort. So this is the way they avoid getting the facts out. But, you know, Cynthia's quite right. Even when we had the civil trial and we did put out all the evidence, the media didn't cover it. They were there when Mrs. King testified and Andy Young, but then they left when the heavy evidence started being put on. The mainstream media will not cover this case and these cases because political assassination is something that is not supposed to exist in this republic.
Is it
does.
There's
and
a connection.
We need Cynthia McKinney back in the, right. in the Congress so at least she could get up every day and she could be putting these things in a record. And we should figure out how to get you back in, Cynthia.
Is there a connection? I throw this out to both of you as we head into the top of the hour and say goodnight. But is there a connection that in terms of the people involved, in the same people in JFK, Malcolm X, Dr. King, Bobby Kennedy?
Don't talk about people. Talk about institutions. The FBI and the intelligence institutions in this country are the foot soldiers for the well-being and the stability of corporate interests who run the society. This has been the case going back time immemorial. They tried to overthrow Mr. Roosevelt. You probably know something about this.
Right.
In 1933. And at that time, it was the Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, the DuPont, and the Harriman, Brown Harriman interests, and the Mellons determined to overthrow Roosevelt. And they sent General Smedley Butler to him, a two-time Congressional Medal Award winner, to tell him he had to step down or they would kill him. This was an attempt because Roosevelt was determined to prosecute that entire crowd, including Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles, for collaborating with the Nazis, for supporting American corporations who were dealing with the Nazis throughout the war. And Mr. Roosevelt died 1 month before the end of the war. And all of the indictments he planned and all the prosecution that he planned went awry. Anybody who's interested in reading, there's a book by a fellow called Glenn Yadon, Y-A-D-O-N, which documents all of this blow by blow. This is the nature of corporate fascism that supported the Nazis during the war, collaborated in joint ventures with IG Farben and their mammoth patent operations. This is nothing new, and the political assassination is just another tactic that's used as a last resort to keep control of this system.
Let's get that book title once again, Bill.
That book is called Nazi Hydra in America. The author is a fellow called Yadon, Y-E-A-D-O-N, Glenn Yadon, and It's a devastatingly thorough research on what happened and how these corporate fascists supported the Nazis. Prescott Bush himself ran 23 of these companies all during the war.
Cynthia, tell me about the MLK Records Act. You introduced two different versions of the same bill, I guess starting about 10 years ago. What was that act about, the Records Act?
Well, it was just about the release of the remaining documents pertaining to the surveillance and then, of course, the murder of Dr. King. And we have lots of records that need to be released. And thank goodness we have William Pepper, who has written at least, three books?
Well, two. The third, Cynthia, is still in preparation, but yes, there are two, Orders to Kill and Active State, and there's a third one that will ultimately be coming out when I find the time to finish it.
Well, there's so much evil and wrongdoing going on that you're just being kept busy, just with the current state of affairs, unfortunately. But we all need that third book to come out as well. And you've inspired me, Bill, to do my PhD on just this very topic of the use of political assassination as a policy tool of the U.S.
Oh, that's great. That's great, Cynthia. Because
yeah.
It's a tactic that is used, you know, and it's immemorial. You can go back to Caesar and before, even you
yes.
know, or Socrates, all the way forward. And the Americans have used it continually around the world. You know, they've killed Mossadegh in 53. They didn't kill him, but they moved him out of power in 53 in order to control the Iranian oil. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's you know, they tried to kill Fidel. They've tried to kill de Gaulle several times, you know, when he got out of line. And of course, you know, Fidel over 40 times. And then we got a whole other series of problems in South America that we can talk about another time.
Yes, I would love to have you on to talk about your good friend and the late Hugo Chavez. I had Greg Palast on the show a couple of weeks ago discussing that, and would love to have both of you on. You have an open invitation to appear on this show anytime. Cynthia, any chance that you will run again?
Well, there are a lot of people who are talking about it. I'm just trying to finish my schoolwork right now and leave the possibility always open, because it seems that the situation in the U.S. Congress has certainly deteriorated since I left in 2007, that's for sure.
Just a quick last point from each of you. How would the world be different today if Dr. King had not been felled by that bullet?
Well, in my view, if Martin King would have been a powerful force for peace, for ending the war in Vietnam much more quickly, and working in collaboration with Bob Kennedy. You have to see those assassinations, which are less 2 months apart, as being twins that were evils that were visited on the people of this republic by those forces of power. But together, Bob was totally committed to ending the war in Vietnam and putting this country on a course to peace. And Martin would have been his ally each step of the way. It's not even clear that Martin King might not have been a running mate of Bob Kennedy's. You know, I knew Bob. I was his citizens chairman of Westchester County, New York, when he ran for the Senate in 64. When I was just a kid.
Can you imagine that ticket? Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. Well, my word. Listen, we're out of time. Bill,
that was not an impossibility. That's all I will say.
Bill Pepper, thank you for this. Cynthia, again, let's have you on again soon and talk some more.
Okay, thank you.
Good to hear you, Cynthia.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
You can follow me here at theconspiracyshow.com. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Hey, friends, good to have you aboard. Also good to have aboard another good friend of the program from Zealand News Network, the executive director, Victor Vigiani. How are you?
Just fine. It's great to be here with you again.
Fresh off a cruise?
Fresh off a cruise. Yes, that's what better way to put it? Fresh off a cruise.
Now, when you're on a cruise ship way out in the middle of the ocean, mm-hmm. you look up at this. I mean, you're someone who spends a lot of time looking up, you know? The stars, mm-hmm. I mean, the absence of light pollution, the stars must be spectacular.
Actually, for three of the nights that we were out there, the sky was absolutely spectacular. It actually looked like a cloudy night, but if you looked up at it, and it was actually clouded with stars. And I spent a lot of time on deck watching things move around. And
anything suspicious?
Well, I did see some things move this way and that, but nothing which you would want to call irregular. Three nights of it, and you know, I must say, in all honesty, not anything spectacular, but there were things moving, and I attribute it to satellites and but nothing anomalous. Too bad, really. But
yeah, that's the thing, though. We don't spend enough time looking up. I mean, who has the time to go outside, you know, in the middle of the night and then just look up? But if we did, who knows what we would see?
Well, there's so much out there, and that's the really disappointing thing about what most people do is that, and the way they interact with it. Because if you did spend time, and one of the nights in the Nevada desert when I was there and seeing the things that actually do occur, that you say, oh my goodness, oh, that shouldn't be happening, and it does, and it really makes you reflect upon what's really going on up in the skies. And we don't spend a lot of time looking at that, so
no.
I guess it's something that most people just take for granted.
Well, yeah, and so our entire perception of the UFO issue has been shaped essentially by Hollywood and what we see on TV and on the big screen, and you know, through that lens, distorted, you know. We're being spoon-fed this particular message, but I've never been able to get a handle on if who's ever in control of the UFO file and if they have a direct pipeline into Hollywood. I've always been conflicted by what message they're trying to send us about E.T. because on the one hand, you have War of the Worlds, E.T. bad, and then you have another Spielberg movie, E.T.
Sure.
good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know what to make of Hollywood, but you know, every year they've with increased regularity now. They've got this huge catalog of movies that they're on the UFO ET issue that's coming down the pipe.
Purposeful confusion.
Well, we've got someone on the line, hopefully, that can help us sort this out.
Let's hope, yes.
Joining us on the line from Merry Old England, Robbie Graham is the editor of SilverScreenSaucers.com. Great website. Check it out. SilverScreenSaucers.com. It's dedicated to news, commentary, articles on Hollywood's UFO movies. He's also currently writing a populist book on the subject of UFOs in Hollywood titled Silver Screen Saucers, Sorting Fact from Fiction in Hollywood's UFO Movies. And we're hoping to do a little bit of that over the next hour here on The Conspiracy Show. And let's welcome aboard Robbie Graham. How are you, Robbie?
Hey, guys. How are you?
You're coming in wonderfully clear at 5 o'clock in the morning. What a great sport you are.
Terrific for you, Robbie.
Great to be on the show again.
How much time do you spend actually screening Hollywood movies that deal with UFOs and ETs?
I suppose the question would be, how much time do I spend doing anything else? Not a great deal of time doing anything else. I know it's pretty much my life right now until this book is finished. A lot of time. I try to watch any film that comes out theatrically or on DVD that deals with the ET visitation issue, and there are a lot of them.
I mean, there's constantly, you know, there's a constant barrage of new films coming out. Last year we had Men in Black 3, The Watch, Prometheus, but then there's the whole back catalog. I mean, can you ever catch up?
It's difficult, actually. You usually don't catch up until several months afterwards, because I usually don't manage to catch every single alien visitation themed film that comes out theatrically each year, although I try to catch most of them. And then you've got the smaller products, which go either straight to DVD or which are released only in a limited way across, you know, certain territories. And these are the films that most people miss. And so with that in mind, I've put together a list of sort of five UFO alien visitation themed films, which I think probably most people would have missed at theatres in 2012. These are sort of slightly less glossy products, typically not American. Well, in fact, not American at all. They're from the UK. They're from Australia, from Italy, for example, Ireland. There are a handful of these titles, which most of them, to be honest, are not probably not worth people's time, unless you are a real UFO buff and sort of are keen to catch every single cinematic representation of the subject. And you know, with that in mind, there are some interesting titles in there. For example, you've got a film that came out last year called, imaginatively titled UFO, which was a UK film directed by Dominic Byrnes. You've got a film called Grabbers, which is an Irish film directed by John Wright. Storage 24, which is another UK movie. You've got Crawl Space, which is quite an interesting one, albeit very bad, Australian film. And got the ridiculously titled The Arrival of Wang, W-A-N-G. And that's an Italian film. Very, very interesting film from a ufological perspective, from an exopolitical perspective.
Well, let's just look at Hollywood for a second, Robbie. Are they just trying to make a good popcorn movie, or is there an agenda? Is there some sort of a meme that's running through these offerings out of Hollywood?
I've dealt before with the issue of, you know, this Hollywood UFO conspiracy. Is there a Hollywood UFO conspiracy? If so, who's behind it? What does it entail? What's the ultimate goal? And yes, there is evidence to suggest that there is, concrete evidence to suggest that historically the US government has been interested in content of Hollywood UFO themed productions. It's monitored these productions. It's at times attempted to censor them, and at times also seeded them to an extent. And typically that's been in a debunking and demystifying capacity. So yes, clearly there has been involvement on the part of the US government in UFO themed movies, many, many cases, and I've written about this quite extensively. The question, though, I think that most people really want to find an answer to is there a acclimation agenda rather than just a debunking one? Again, there is limited evidence to suggest that there is possibly an acclimation agenda, or has been in a handful of cases scattered across the decades. It's not something where there appears to be an overarching goal or a clear message, shall we say. So, for example, you've got the Robert Emmenegger case of the early 1970s, where many branches of the US government, as well as NASA, all collaborated on a film which very clearly gave the idea that we are being visited by ET. You've got the Ward Kimball case of the 1950s, where you had the Disney animator Ward Kimball claim that there was a joint project between the Air Force and Walt Disney, which was again intended to acclimate people to the idea of ET visitation and ET reality. And that was ultimately aborted, as was, the Emmenegger project went ahead, but it didn't go ahead in the way that it had intended to be, with allegedly real UFO footage included. You've got a handful of other cases since then, which are interesting, where you've got collaboration again between Disney and the CIA and NORAD, for example, on the 2009 movie Race to Witch Mountain. And again, it's probably another five or six cases like that, but they are scattered. They don't seem to be the films that are coming out. Along those lines, don't seem to have a clear message. They seem disparate in their agendas, and so I think that if there is an acclimation agenda, it's one that changes in its specific nature from decade to decade, depending on what's going on behind the scenes, I guess. But to summarize that, in terms of acclimation, in terms of an alleged acclimation agenda, the evidence is patchy, but it's there. The evidence for censorship and monitoring is concrete and overwhelming. But again, overwhelmingly, we're talking here about a natural cultural phenomenon with UFO movies. It's entered popular culture. You've got a subcultural subject, which is the UFO phenomenon, which in the past, several decades, especially in the last especially since the 1990s and the explosion of Roswell and popular culture, the birth of the X-Files, and then you had films like Independence Day, Men in Black. All of these films took this subcultural discourse, these sightings, which were really restricted to the pages of specialized UFO literature, and all of a sudden they've been brought into the mainstream. And now it's very hard to sort of sort back the fantasy because Hollywood is very liberal with the truth as represented on the page, and then how it kind of translates that to the screen.
So would you figure that, you know, back with, let's begin with one of my favorites, I guess, you know, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And that was an absolutely magnificent piece of cinematography, the way it was handled back then. And you've just written a recent article on that, I know. Would you have, in your estimation, would you think that that was sort of an experiment with the American sort of public culture at the time to assess their, the American public's perception of the UFO ET issue at the time, to kind of gauge where they were at? Because we all know that that was a very powerful film, and it was, I think it was done in a very concerted effort to kind of assess the American public's perception about the UFO issue at the time. And I guess the second part of that question was, how much more sophisticated has it become since then?
Well, yes, The Day the Earth Stood Still is one that people have always pointed to as being suspicious, shall we say, just simply in terms of its content, how far ahead of its time it was in terms of the UFO subject, and its representations of specific ecological details like liquid metal, for example, that was developed earlier before the Roswell, but which didn't actually surface in public reports until years later, and many other aspects there as well. It's a very interesting film, and it's one that I'd looked at for years, but never found anything really concrete on until recently. Again, it's still not concrete, but there is now, I would say, quite strong circumstantial evidence to support the idea that indeed The Day the Earth Stood Still probably was some form of test of public reaction to the idea that we are being visited. And so what you've got with The Day the Earth Stood Still, well, to put it in context, in 1983...
Let me just... Robbie, I got to jump in here. We've got the music percolating up, so that means we're going into a break. We'll come back. Robbie Graham, the editor of SilverScreenSaucers.com. Victor Vigiani in studio, the executive director of Z-Land News Network, back with more of The Conspiracy Show as we examine Hollywood and the UFO ET issue. Welcome back. Victor Vigiani, executive director of Z-Land News Network, joins me in studio on the line. Joining us by Skype from England is Robbie Graham, editor of SilverScreenSaucers.com. SilverScreenSaucers.com, as he discusses the cultural, industrial, political processes by which Hollywood's UFO movie content is shaped, as well as the impact of these movies on popular perceptions of the UFO phenomenon. Now, I can understand why intelligence organizations, the military, might be interested in massaging the message that's coming out of a Hollywood as it pertains to, well, just in terms of propaganda, using Hollywood as a propaganda instrument. And I can understand if it's a movie about communism or about an anti-drug message or something like that. But for the life of me, I can't understand why the military, the CIA, would be interested in a movie about flying saucers and ETs unless, you know, they're real and they know it, and therefore they feel the need to control the message. I mean, is that obvious? Am I oversimplifying?
No, that's right. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's precisely why they're interested. But, you know, that's not really a big surprise. If you look at the government's own documentation on the UFO subject, CIA documentation, FBI documentation, if you look at Air Force documentation, reams and reams and reams of it. Although it never explicitly spells out the, you know, probable extraterrestrial nature of the phenomenon, it does everything but, you know, if you look at it on as a collective of documents, and there are thousands and thousands of documents, the picture that emerges is one of a government that is deeply, deeply concerned by a phenomenon that they are powerless to control and which seems to be non-terrestrial in origin. That's what the documents say, essentially. as I say, without ever explicitly sort of, you know, coming to that conclusion. Because of course, if such documents exist, then so they're not going to be released, at least not for a good while to come. However, so if you take this idea that the government is deeply concerned, and indeed that is borne out by the documentation, then it makes sense that the government would want to have a hand in how this phenomenon is represented on screens, particularly on the silver screen. The government has always recognised the immense power of cinema to shape public perception of hot-button issues. And of course, well, arguably, there is no hotter political issue than the UFO phenomenon. And therefore, you know, you've really got to get in. You've got to get your hand in. And you know, luckily for the US government, the Air Force, various branches, as well as the CIA, have been involved in Hollywood in a collaborative process for decades. And the CIA got involved in a big way in 1953. The Air Force, various branches of the military, rather, before that. And so, you know, there is a very close collaboration. Even NASA's in on the game now. You name it, as a government organization, it's in Hollywood. In fact, it's literally in Hollywood, because on the 12th floor of the Oppenheimer building in Los Angeles is the entire floor is U.S. government branches, which are based in Hollywood. So you've got the Air Force team of Hollywood collaborators, you've got the Navy, the Army, you've got the National Guard, you've got NASA. All of those guys have offices in the Oppenheimer building, and they work on a 24-hour, you know, not 24-hour, but 7 days a week basis with Hollywood filmmakers in order to, in their own words, improve accuracy and authenticity in those films. So, and of course, they do work with big UFO-related productions as well, and there are numerous productions over the years where you've had military collaboration on UFO-themed films.
So if that's the case, and let's just sort of look ahead here. Excuse me, Robbie. Just for a second, and I'm trying to wrap my mind around what you're saying. If this issue, let's just assume they're dealing with this issue in the way they are. It seems to me there's a very concerted effort behind what they're doing. It's quite clear. I mean, there's, you know, you don't have to be a brain surgeon to see there's a very concerted effort to characterize this issue in a certain way. And so many agencies, NASA, FBI, the film industry, have gone out of their way to characterize it in a certain way. But down the road somewhere, when this stuff all comes out in the wash, when we realize that we are, in fact, being engaged by these extraterrestrial civilizations, and that's going to come. It's only a matter of time, in my opinion. How will the film industry and the government, let's just say from your point of view, the film industry, be able to rationalize what they've done to us in order to characterize it in this way? When it comes out, in fact, they've told us it's this way, it's that way, the ETs are this, the ETs are that, but in fact, we've been conditioned to believe it's a certain way, and then in the final analysis, it's something totally different, and we've been tricked and completely... How would you characterize it? We've been jury-rigged to believe it's a certain way, and it's not going to work out that way. Won't they be behind the eight ball when this all comes out to show us that it's another way and not the way they're portraying it?
Okay, well, when we talk about Hollywood being involved, being complicit, which it is in a general way, as I say, you have to be careful not to generalize. When we talk about Hollywood, we're not talking about Hollywood as an entire industry from top to bottom being involved in a acclamation agenda or a censorship agenda with regards to UFOs. That's absolutely not the case. When we talk about Hollywood, we're talking about a handful, really, but more realistically, over the years, it's going to have been several hundred people in key positions, in choke points, as I like to call them, throughout the industry. You have certain writers, for example, certain script doctors, certain producers, certain studio heads, perhaps certain directors, and even certain actors, who over the decades have been friendly to the causes of the US government, not just on the UFO issue, but on a broad range of issues.
Of course, yeah.
And so these are people who, for lack of a better word, you might term assets. And there have been many, many assets over the years. And of course, there continue to be assets in the industry. You only need really a few people in key positions in order to exert your influence effectively. So when we talk about Hollywood, we're not talking about everybody. It's not everyone who's involved. Most people, the vast majority of people in Hollywood have no idea. And even the people who are being used as assets on this subject, even they will only have a very, very limited amount of knowledge on the subject. Everything is on a need-to-know basis.
Of course.
So I doubt even the assets themselves would ever be outed anyway, even after the fact. So I don't think anyone's really going to be held accountable in Hollywood necessarily. As far as the secret keepers in the corporate world and in the world of politics are concerned, well, that's another matter. But in Hollywood, I think it's going to be very hard ever to root out exactly who was involved and how they did it. Although we can speculate with some good facts, at our disposal.
Help me understand though what the message is, because as Victor said, if the game here is to acclimatize us, I mean, I wonder, is it really? Because what we see more often, and I don't see a lot of UFO movies or ET movies, but it seems that they're playing up sort of the absurdist aspect of the, if I look at Men in Black and the man working behind the counter at 7-Eleven is an alien and so forth.
If I were to have to put my finger on what the overarching message is, I would have to say, again, this is not to suggest that there is a grand conspiracy, because I think that it's more sporadic than that. There are isolated efforts over the years. But if there is an overarching message behind all of these sporadic efforts over the years, then it seems to be this, essentially. UFOs are real. So we are being visited by extraterrestrials. However, the government is, and when this will sound strange to listeners, but the message is that the government is essentially not to be held accountable for the decades-long cover-up, and that the government has done its best in a very difficult situation, and that the governments are the ones to turn to when the shit hits the fan, if I can use that phrase, because the ETs are hostile, and that's the message that Hollywood puts out. ETs are hostile, we should fear them. There are exceptions to this, of course. You have your ETs and you have your Cocoons and your Starman, but overwhelmingly ETs are extremely hostile, and the people you have to turn to in these times of crisis are the US Air Force, the Army, NASA sometimes, the CIA.
Well,
Richard, the Men in Black as well, which the message of the Men in Black, of course, strangely, is that, it's in the Will Smith rap, go on with your lives, forget the Roswell crap.
And that, of course, is the message. That is the message that they want to get out there, that despite whoever the ETs are, the message is that they want to get through is that it's okay, whatever ET is, whoever or whatever they are, the United States Air Force will, in fact, be the Independence Day relievers of the pain of the UFO ET incursion into humanity. And that, it, to me, is a false perception. It's something that's absolutely, totally, and objectively in opposition to what this thing might be. So why are they presenting this particular point of view and using Hollywood as their main construct as to how the American and I guess global audience needs to perceive ET, while there may be a different message? How does that other message get out? And if it isn't possible to get that out, how can it be that that message could even possibly be transmitted to the rest of humanity? And I think we're being sort of deluded into the fact that this ET message is something very, very different than what it really is.
But I could. Aren't there enough examples, whether you're talking about contact or you mentioned ET, enough examples that ET is friendly and ET is here to save us from ourselves, and ET is, they're trying to welcome us into this, this cosmic galactic brother. Yeah. Aren't there enough of those movies out there that would sort of counter that argument that they're trying to shape the, ET is bad?
Well, I guess there are, but I guess my point is that it could be something benevolent, or it could be something hostile. I don't know which it is. I keep on, and I've said this on the show many times before, Richard, when we find out what this is all about, it will in fact be totally different than what we perceive. So it could be hostile, it could be benevolent, but the fact of the matter is that the United States government is using these agencies to profess a specific point of view about what the extraterrestrial presence is all about is orchestrated. And to the extent that it's orchestrated, in my opinion, is extremely biased.
Right. Well, we can always count on the government for that.
Of course. I mean, that's the way it's going to work out anyways.
Right. Well, Robbie, again, going back to the message, you've got the ET is here to save us. You've got ET is here to destroy us.
Okay, so what you'll find is that...
Is that some sort of sonic dissonance that's done on purpose?
No, the films in which E.T. is here to save us, but for, well, 99% of those, and there's really only a handful of those films anyway, but 99% of them have had no military support. They've had no official government involvement.
There you go.
Okay, so NASA was involved in a very limited capacity in Spielberg's E.T., for example, but it flat out refused to have any involvement, as did the Air Force in Spielberg's Close Encounters. And then all of the other friendly E.T. movies, they don't have government involvement in them at all. Whereas the ones that have collaboration are things like Battle Los Angeles, for example, are things like the Transformers franchise. In the Transformers franchise, you'll have... War of the Worlds, Spielberg's War of the Worlds had military collaboration, and numerous other films. I mean, some hostile E.T. movies also get denied cooperation from the Air Force, as Independence Day was denied cooperation from the Air Force, for example, because it refused to remove references to Area 51 and Roswell, because it was one of it's really the first major motion picture that used those ideas in a really big pivotal way in terms of its narrative, and I think they were very worried about that. Obviously, they realised that you can't keep denying collaboration to Hollywood films that use these terms, because because it was already exploding into popular culture, and if they were going to get their message across, they had to start to bend a little bit with Hollywood filmmakers. So as you say, the really good examples to look at in terms of military collaboration and getting that message across are the Transformers films, as well as Battle Los Angeles, for example. These are films where the military is portrayed as a force for good. Secrecy is essentially justified because the ETs are hostile and the cover-up is being orchestrated to protect people.
It's all suddenly very clear to me now, Robbie. Now I understand it. Now I get it. Okay, we'll take a time out. Come back. Victor Vigiani, ZLAN News Network, Robbie Graham, SilverScreenSaucers.com. Welcome back, and again, just a special hello and welcome to our new affiliate, KGY AM 1240 Olympia, Washington. Hope you're enjoying the program. Would love to hear from listeners up in Washington. Robbie Graham is with us, the editor of SilverScreenSaucers.com, and Victor Vigiani, a good friend, executive director of ZLAN News Network, in studio as we talk about Hollywood and the UFO ET issue. Robbie, I know primarily you're looking at motion pictures coming out of Hollywood and some independents and so forth. Do you delve into documentaries? I'm wondering if there is any control influence by the military, the intelligence groups in the documentary field.
Well, as I referred to earlier, the 1974 movie, feature-length documentary feature by Robert Emmenegger called UFOs, Past, Present and Future, which has been extensively documented now. It's really the strongest case ever for government collaboration with filmmakers on the UFO issue in an acclamation way. This is a film that very clearly put across the message that UFOs are real, ETs are visiting us. As I say, it had cooperation from the Air Force, from the Army, from the Navy, from NASA, and it seems to have gone all the way up to Richard Nixon in terms of the person who gave the go-ahead for the documentary to be produced. It was supposed to feature allegedly real alien landing footage, which was pulled at the last minute. There was, again, this mid-1950s project collaboration between the Air Force and Walt Disney that Ward Kimball discussed. where again, allegedly real footage, not landing footage, but real UFO footage was promised and withdrawn at the last minute, and the project was abandoned. These are pretty strong cases, especially the Emanator case, because the documentary, of course, was eventually released, albeit without the footage, and was nominated for a Golden Globe. And even without the footage, it's a very compelling documentary that really does put across a very strong message, and is officially supported by the US government. In more recent years, you had a lot of people have been pointing, especially in recent weeks and months, to the 1995 Walt Disney documentary / promo, Alien Encounters from New Tomorrowland, which was a very strange 45-minute documentary which was released in the mid-90s. It was broadcast on literally about five or six American TV networks without prior announcement, and was never seen again. And people have talked about it for years afterwards, saying it was a test of public reaction. And it was a film that put across an unambiguous message that aliens are real. It was a documentary presented by Robert Urich. And, you know, it was bashing the viewer over the head with the idea that we are not alone and that UFOs are absolutely, without doubt, alien and we are being visited. And we better get used to it, because any day now, the cat's going to come out of the bag. And then this documentary was produced and it disappeared. However, I interviewed the director and the writer of that documentary, there called Andrew Thomas, a couple of years ago, and I did quite a long interview with him, and he satisfied me largely that if there was a conspiracy, certainly he wasn't in on it. He was a guy who, I mean, you can read his full interview with me and my full take on it on my blog, on my silverscreensources.com site. Suffice to say, I don't think that suspicious. I do think there are lingering doubts in my mind as to what the real goal was with that documentary. It's very interesting, but certainly he's adamant that there was no conspiracy here. Obviously, he would say that.
Would there be?
There was, but honestly, but I genuinely don't think that it's as suspicious as it seemed. There is more recently, of course. I mean, you've got documentaries like, you know, independent filmmakers like James Fox, for example, making documentaries, excellent documentaries on the UFO subject nowadays, which are free of government influence, and they're putting across a very interesting perspective on the subject. There's another documentary which I'm trying to think of, which is more recent, and I can't think what it is now. But generally, the government doesn't tend to get involved. Oh, there we go. It just occurred to me. The TV broadcast UFO cover-up live, rather, from the late 1980s. This was again, Emanator was involved in that, and you had, you know, the Avery involved in that, and you had all sorts of very interesting spooks involved in that.
Of course. Well, the other aspect to that, Robbie, is that the History Channel here in Canada, I'm not sure exactly how it's portrayed in the UK or even in the United States, but the History Channel over the last little while has really put forward the ancient alien documentaries. I mean, there's just documentary after documentary. I'm not sure exactly who's producing it. And then, of course, there's the new alien mystery series that's being proffered by another network. And I just don't know who's exactly behind these. And these are very well documented programs that are taking off and really presenting a really very clear perspective on the perspective of the UFO ET issue.
Okay, let's take a quick time out. We'll come back. Robbie Graham, SilverScreenSaucers.com, Victor Vigiani, Zealand News Network, Hollywood and the UFO ET issue, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Hollywood and the UFO ET issue. You mentioned a documentary that came out in 1974. Very interesting year, 1974. That we were supposed to have another lunar mission that year, Apollo 18. Of course, the last year we went to the moon was 1973, and then the Apollo 18 launch is scuttled, canceled, and we never went back. And then a couple of years ago, I think in 2011, there was a movie called Apollo 18, the premise of which was secretly they sent this mission up to the moon, Apollo 18. It was some sort of the cover story was it was some sort of satellite retrieval mission, but they actually went to the moon, and then all hell broke loose on the surface. Some sort of an encounter with some sort of extraterrestrial race on the moon. They never came back, and that's why we've never been back. Have you seen Apollo 18, and what are your thoughts on that? And I'll get your feedback on that as well, Victor, because I think you've seen it. I have not.
Yeah, I've seen Apollo 18. It's a pretty bad film, but it's very interesting, in terms of my own research. Not least of all because of its viral marketing campaign, which fooled a lot of people, which is quite worrying. In recent years, you've seen a trend emerge in Hollywood where you have filmmakers seeking actively to dissolve the boundaries between UFO fact and fantasy through the utilization of these kind of verite filmmaking techniques and also willfully deceptive viral marketing campaigns. And so you've got The Fourth Kind, for example, which is a very good example of this, which used real news reports and the fake Universal Studios created fake news clippings, which was reported to be real. Ultimately, was sued for it. So they wanted to blur fact and fantasy to make people curious and not to know where the line lies between fact and fantasy. Same was the case with Apollo 18, of course. Has roots in reality. But what happened was you had, in the months preceding the film's release, you had a website, a pop-up called lunartruth.com. And this was actually a viral marketing website for the Apollo 18 movie, but people thought that it was a real website, that contained lots of classified material. And it does look like that. It's a very authentic website. There's a whole bunch of documentation on that site, on lunartruth.com. Documents on there that are fake and created specifically to virally promote the film. As I say, sites like this are becoming massively popular with Hollywood filmmakers nowadays. But at the same time, on that same website, you've also got real documents, the ones with the real documents taken from government archives, and they're put side by side with fake ones, and it's impossible to tell the difference. So you are literally having the direct blurring of fact and fantasy to create a new narrative, really.
So if that's the case, then let's just suppose that this, and I've watched the movie, and it's really a very, very disturbing movie, if anyone wants to watch it. But the actual website, Lunar Truth, is even more disturbing. So let's assume that this thing was done, and it was sponsored with X number of dollars to do whatever it did, both with the movie and the website. What motivation would anyone have, whoever, and I've looked at who produced the movie, but let's assume that who those people are unnamed. What motivation would there be behind them developing a movie of that prescriptive nature? And it's a very, very powerful movie on one count. And then to develop a website on top of that with very, very sophisticated looking documents, whose interest would it be to develop both of those memes, both the movie and the website, to conjure up a certain perception about what the extraterrestrial issue might be all about? In whose interest would that be?
Well, to be honest, I really don't see anything suspicious behind Apollo 18. I don't see this as a.
You really don't? You really don't? Seriously?
Yeah. Really don't.
I can only go.
It's tempting to be able to look at every single Hollywood film about the UFO issue and see evidence, see the fingerprints of the CIA or something, because it touches on this subject or that subject in this way or that way. And if you took that approach, then everything would be a conspiracy. And I can only go on evidence I have to see at least some evidence in the film's production history to suggest that there is some kind of collaboration or hidden hand. And I honestly don't see that with Apollo 18. I see a small independent film that's very clever, very sophisticated in its viral approach, and has a very cool idea that taps into conspiracy culture. and which is essentially pop culture now.
But Robbie, people don't go out and spend money like that to lose it. I mean, these people spent a lot of money to put that movie together. It's a very, very sophisticated movie. And then on top of that, the website. People don't go out and spend money like that just for the hell of it. There's somebody has to be, you know, behind them to proffer that kind of information with the dollars that, that have been behind it. I'm not suggesting that it is, in fact, a conspiracy. But who would put up money to lose money to begin with? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, I believe, and I have to double check this. Dimension. Apollo 18 was produced by Dimension Films. Dimension Films actually used to be owned by Disney, but is no longer owned by Disney. So I think it was the Weinstein brothers. I think it was Harvey Weinstein who owned Dimension Films, but it's no longer owned by Disney. But it's an independent. But basically, Dimension Films is an independent,
right,
very successful production company with a long history of successful productions. So we're not talking about, you know, a tiny little amateur production company here. This is a film that did have. It was a low budget film. It was a low budget film, and they were hoping to basically replicate success of things like the Blair Witch Project, where you have a film that's produced small means, with a cast of unknowns. You produce it for a very small amount of money. You use a very sophisticated viral marketing campaign, as with the Blair Witch Project, for example, and The Fourth Kind is another example of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hope that it catches on virally and explodes and just rakes in the cash. Sometimes it works, as it did with the Blair Witch Project. It also was successful with The Fourth Kind, which was a box office success. Apollo 18, it didn't work. It was one of those ones where, you know, they had no reason to believe that it wouldn't work, and they hoped that it would be part of that trend. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, it didn't work, and they lost money on that film. But, you know, that's the way it works. You invest in the marketing in the hope that it's going to pay off, especially if your film has no major actors to sell it. You know, this isn't a film where you can say Apollo 18, come and see George Clooney in Apollo 18.
Okay, so let me take you back then to 1952 with the day the Earth stood still. Do you think the CIA at the time took that same kind of gamble?
I don't think the CIA wouldn't have funded the day the Earth stood still. There's a distinction to be made. So 20th Century Fox funded the day the Earth stood still. 20th Century Fox was massive, and still is, I'm sorry, but was a massive, massive film studio. They don't need to go to the CIA and say, CIA, please give us some money to make a film. What happens is the CIA... they subtly influence the script, for example, or, you know, they will suggest ideas through a Hollywood chain, and it will start to filter in or percolate into the film. But there's no money needs to be put up by the CIA. The government doesn't fund UFO movies.
Of course, yes, I understand that. But you think the message, though, that would have been in their experiment to put this in place the way 20th Century Fox did do it, do you think the intent was similar to? I'm trying to connect the dots here, okay, Robbie?
Yeah, no, I think the day the Earth stood still, 1951, was really an exceptional case. I don't think we've ever seen anything quite like it since, to be honest, on that scale. And it was, I think, first time you saw the CIA and perhaps other government branches dip their toe in this issue in terms of the entertainment industry. They wanted to see what they could do. And what effect it might have.
Of course, yeah.
Robbie, we've just got about 2 minutes. Let's just take a couple of minutes here and talk about what's coming up later this year, 2013, maybe next year. Do you have your eye on a couple of films that you suspect have CIA, naval intelligence fingerprints all over it, and you're really sort of keen to find out what that meme is going to be all about?
There's one film which I'm very interested to see if it eventually comes to the box office. This is something that's been rumored to. I mean, it's been on the slate for a couple of years now, but it's been delayed. You've had different directors and writers assigned to it. This is a film called Umbra, UMBRA, which is a Latin word meaning the darkest part of the shadow. And Umbra is also an intelligence code word used in the National Security Agency. It's a top secret clearance. It's an above top secret clearance. So you've got top secret Umbra, for example. And there are UFO documentation documents which are labeled with Top Secret Umbra. So this is a film that's actually about the alleged Dulce facility in New Mexico.
Yes.
And so this is going to be very, very interesting. It's been rewritten. It's been assigned a new director, two new directors, in fact. So it's a film that's clearly having production troubles. And it's a film that's going to be any film that's going to try and put on screen, it's going to depict the government as being engaged in horrific biogenetic research in a top secret underground facility dealing with the issue of aliens. I've read the script, by the way. It was leaked online a couple of years ago, and you can read it on my website. The script has been rewritten, however, so it'd be interesting to see what happens with this. But it is a film that taps very directly into the story of Phil Schneider and his testimony regarding the Dulce facility. It's a film that involves collaboration between the narrative involves collaboration between the government and hostile extraterrestrials and experimentation on humans. It's going to be very, very dark and sinister.
Schneider was a whistleblower who talked about alien battles at Dulce and later died under mysterious circumstances or was murdered, correct?
Correct. And the same kind of thing plays out in Umbra. So that's going to be a very interesting film. It was supposed to be released in 2012, then it was supposed to be released in 2013, and now we're expecting it probably in about 2014. It'll be very interesting to see whether or not that gets any government assistance.
Indeed. Listen, Robbie, great having you on again. We'll do it again soon. SilverScreenSaucers.com, and give us an update, the status of your upcoming book.
Oh, it's getting there. It's not quick enough, but it's getting there. I'm every day working on it. I'm hoping to have it finished by the end of this year.
I'm going to hold you to that. Okay. Well, we'll have you back on. Thank you for this, Robbie.
Oh, no problem. It's been great. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Robbie Graham, SilverScreenSaucers.com. Victor, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. It's always to spend an hour with you on this, and we just get to realize this problem is bigger than we can ever imagine.
Well, when next we meet, we'll probably be over at the luxurious confines of our new facility just west from here, and looking forward to sitting down with you again.
Of course, it'll be a pleasure.
All right, next week, mark this one down. Gerald Celente, one of the top trends forecasters in the world. We'll talk about, everything from the coming economic collapse and all wonderful sunny topics like that. Gerald Celente. Tim Spreen, thanks as always. And in the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing hidden that won't be made known. Nothing revealed. Nothing concealed that won't be revealed. Nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. Would you hear in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops, move over, Aphrodite, I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.